And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This week, we launched the first in our series of weekly Earth Summits, bringing you the perspectives of the world's leading scientists, advocates, and leaders as they speak out each week to unite the efforts to save life on Earth. At no time in history has the challenge been so direct and the opportunity so commanding to form a new global Earth network to redirect our future to a new sustainable world order. We invite you along on this historic exploration of possibilities when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Beginning with this show, the Wild Side News adds a new feature, the Weekly Earth Summit, and changes its format slightly to provide a most concise and effective weekly update on what's happening in the realms of nature and the environment. The Weekly Earth Summit will open all shows from now on and bring you a concise commentary by our panel of regular contributors, including Carl Pope, Executive Director of the Sierra Club, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, President of the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment, and Advisor to the World Bank, United Nations Foundation, and the Smithsonian, Dr. Charles Kennell, recent Director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and a member of the Pew Commission on the Oceans, Dave Foreman, author, iconoclast, and earth advocate, and founder of the Rewilding Institute, Dr. Matthew Sleeth, a leading spokesman for the creation care movement of the faith-based communities and author of Serve God, Save the Planet, Dr. Robin Moore with Conservation International, Dr. Mark Beckhoff, preeminent animal behaviorist, author, and co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and student advocates Ben Lowe and Emma Sleeth and others from our nation's college campuses. Besides the Weekly Earth Summit that opens each show, we will then move on in segment two to cover the current nature news and then focus in on our special topic. Today, we talk with people along the West Coast who are struggling with the sudden illness and death of hundreds of seabirds, seals, and whales as a result of a particularly lethal strain of deadly algae. We hope these programming changes will make the Wild Side News more responsive to your needs as a committed nature advocate. And so now, without further fanfare, we introduce the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Today, our regular panelists provide an overview of thought on issues relevant to us all. So now we open today's summit with Dr. Charles Kennell, recent director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography.
One of the major events celebrating the centennial year of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, 2003, was a reunion and symposium celebrating the 50th anniversary of Scripps's great mid-pack expedition and its predecessor, Capricorn. I'm afraid that my opening remarks may have dismayed the veterans who were gathered there, for I said that their great research cruise brought the age of European exploration that started with Prince Henry the Navigator to a definitive end after 500 years. To borrow a thought that John Maynard Keynes had applied to his Cambridge predecessor, Isaac Newton, they were the last generation to look upon the world through the eyes of the ancients. The fact that oceanographers had become involved with hydrogen bomb tests already presaged that the world to come was to be very different, and a few, especially Roger Revelle, saw where things were going. From our present vantage point in time, when every square meter of Earth has been surveyed by satellite and can be Googled at will, the challenge is no longer to discover what is there, but to understand how the many complex parts of the Earth system interact. The challenge is not to push outwards, but to connect together. We now know what these great pioneers did not. Our civilization faces an entirely new situation. Humans have always altered their environment to suit their needs, but their impact only reached global proportions in the last 50 years. New words have entered public discourse. Biodiversity decline, habitat fragmentation, deforestation, increasing drought, desertification, ozone hole, atmospheric brown cloud, retreating glaciers, disappearing Arctic ice, sea level rise, and the granddaddy of them all, global warming. The state of nature, if it ever existed, has disappeared. And the world we study today will be different tomorrow because of what we humans do. We also know, as never before, that Earth science has an essential role to play in preserving our civilization and the planet that supports it so lavishly.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. Next, we hear from Carl Pope, Executive Director of the Sierra Club.
America's heartland took a giant step forward towards licking global warming. Kansas City Power and Light entered into a legally binding settlement with the Sierra Club to offset all 100% of the emissions of carbon dioxide that will come from a new coal plant KCP&L is constructing. The utility will also quadruple its planned investment in renewables like wind and solar. It's going to jointly work with the Sierra Club to change the rules for all public utilities in Kansas and Missouri to ensure that by 2020, KCP&L will have reduced its emissions of carbon dioxide by 20%. This agreement breaks fundamentally new ground. It raises the bar for all electrical utilities. No coal-based utility previously had made these kinds of legally enforceable commitments. The agreement sends a strong signal that while this may not be the end of the coal rush, nor even the beginning of the end, it might, in Winston Churchill's famous phrase, be the end of the beginning. The comprehensive nature of the settlement, a drastic limit on new coal construction, full offset of carbon dioxide, the cleanup of Kansas City Power and Light's existing power plants in Kansas City, including 90% of the mercury, dramatic investments in renewables and efficiency, and a partnership with the Sierra Club to lay the framework for an even cleaner and more economic future for these two states, make this a watershed. I was talking with Michael Chesser, the CEO of the company, just before we inked the deal. He told me, once we started talking, we realized we really did have common goals. He said he looked forward to working with the Sierra Club to persuade state government in Kansas and Missouri to make it legally possible for his power company to meet all of its electricity needs with efficiency and renewables and avoid further coal investments completely. This agreement is a win for our climate, for the environment, and for the residents of the Kansas City area. It's just the latest sign that smart energy solutions such as wind power and energy efficiency are gathering momentum and popularity because they make economic sense. Time to deal with global warming is indeed short, but America is moving. It may be a much earlier spring thaw than we expected for the new energy economy, and a good thing, too.
Thank you, Carl. Dr. Matthew Sleeth adds some inspiring words about his faith and our future.
There are three ways people approach issues. As regards the environment, some focus on its history, others study the actual problem, and some work on the solution. My training in emergency medicine taught me to focus on the latter when time is of the essence. What has gotten us into our precarious position is not a lack of science, engineering, or politics. It is a lack of love. Yet this four-letter word and the power it holds is absent from most environmental rhetoric. Love isn't measurable. It can't be patented or traded on Wall Street. Yet it is why we marry, have children, and sacrifice. In its absence, we hoard, act selfishly, and go to war. I come to the environmental table because of my faith. I love the Creator, so I must love what the Creator created. When asked how one gets to heaven, Jesus responded that we must love our God and our neighbor as ourselves. Nowhere are the qualities and attributes of love better described than in the book of Corinthians. And I quote, "Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous, boastful, proud, or rude. Love does not demand its own way. Love is not irritable, and it keeps no record of when it has been wronged. It is never glad about injustice, but rejoices whenever truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures through every circumstance." End quote. Science, politics, and engineering may be powerful and necessary parts of the environmental fix, yet they will ultimately fail if we do not take seriously the need to love one another.
His recent book, Serve God, Save the Planet, expands on his perspective. We're hearing a lot these days about threats to the very fabric of life on Earth. We now hear from panelists who wish to focus on this important topic. We begin with Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who is given credit for coining the term biodiversity and directs the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment.
I think the single most riveting environmental change in my entire career is the discovery a couple of years ago that the oceans have becoming acid, literally 30% more acid than in pre-industrial times. We've heard of acid lakes, we've heard of acid rain, but now we have acid oceans. And one might ask, what does that mean? Well, it turns out that there is this enormous number of species in the oceans that build skeletons from calcium carbonate. And that depends on an equilibrium, which is dependent on pH and how acid or alkaline the oceans are. And so if the trends continue, this is all driven by elevated CO2 in the atmosphere, basically some of which becomes carbonic acid. If those trends continue, you will reach points at which corals and mollusks and tiny little planktonic organisms that build shells of calcium carbonate could literally not only have trouble making their shells could dissolve while they're alive.
Adding to Dr. Lovejoy's concerns, we now hear from Dr. Robin Moore, who is an amphibian conservation officer with the Amphibian Specialist Group and works with Conservation International to restore and maintain viable animal populations around the world.
Amphibians have been around on Earth virtually unchanged for over 100 million years. This is far longer than we have. They're survivors. It's alarming, therefore, that we're now experiencing a mass extinction crisis within this entire class of animals. As a direct or indirect result of human actions, almost a third of all amphibian species are currently threatened with extinction. It's too late for many of these species, which have already gone, but we still have a chance to do something to halt this alarming trend and to save many of the species that are on the brink of extinction. The amphibian extinction crisis is a symptom of a much larger problem that threatens the very ecosystems that we depend on for clean water, clean air, and food. These ecosystems that we often take for granted may be telling us something, and we need to finally sit up and pay attention. We risk going beyond the point of no return if we do not respond quickly. Amphibians are often cited as early warning systems. They provide an indication of the health of an ecosystem. Their permeable skins take in everything that's in the environment. They're associated with both land and water. They typically lay unprotected eggs and therefore are exposed to the elements. They're very susceptible to subtle changes in the environment, and as such, they act as barometers of ecosystem health. If we lose the amphibians, we can expect a domino effect. We have no idea what will be affected next, whether it will be birds or mammals, including humans. So why should we really care if we lose frogs? Try to imagine a forest that was once alive with the sounds of frog calls and is now completely silent. It's hard for us to imagine this until it really happens. Many frogs are very closely associated with the fresh water that we rely on. They provide an indicator of a healthy, clean water supply. Feeding on invertebrates, they control the number of insects that are crop pests and vectors for disease such as malaria and dengue fever. If frogs disappear from the food web, the domino effects will be massive. The amphibian extinction crisis is happening before our very eyes and is sending us a signal. The realization has prompted a response from the global community. Next week, I will talk about what the Amphibian Specialist Group of the World Conservation Union are doing to tackle the problem. In subsequent weeks, I will focus on individual species and individual case studies to give an overview of the threats that are facing amphibians on a case-by-case basis.
The efforts to appreciate the value of our animal species often begins in our own backyard. We now hear from Dr. Mark Beckhoff, Professor Emeritus at Colorado State University of Boulder, whose exploration of the complex emotional lives of animals has earned him a Guggenheim Fellowship. He helps us open our perceptions to the animals around us.
I think one of the reasons they try to figure out cats and dogs, focusing a lot on their differences, is because dogs have evolved from social wolves, and cats have basically evolved, you know, from more solitary species. And so, you know, there's no doubt that cats, on average, seem to be more loners than do dogs. You know, people once again have looked at the play behavior of these animals. They've looked at the way in which they mark out their territories. And so, you know, the basic bottom line is that, on average, dogs are more social, and on average, cats are less social. But what's fascinating is that cats really are social. A German ethologist named Paul Lehausen years ago pointed out that there's really no such thing as a solitary animal. And, of course, there are solitary animals, but what he meant was that even though cats are more solitary than dogs, they do scent mark and they deposit urine all over the place and maybe some glandular substances. Other cats come across them and they change their ways. They change their direction of travel, for example. So what's really exciting is that, in fact, there is social regulation among cats, but sometimes you only see one cat doing it, whereas in the dogs and wolves and other social carnivores, you actually see two or more animals somehow negotiating space. So I find that to be really fascinating.
We will hear from Dr. Beckhoff each week here at the Weekly Earth Summit. Now, a youthful perspective from college student and nature advocate, Ben Lowe.
You've probably noticed that the environment has a new advocate. It's the evangelical Christian. Actually, this really isn't new. The most recent evangelical concern for the environment started back in the 1970s and is commonly referred to as creation care. For far too long, however, creation care was treated as a fringe movement within the church. This is changing, and it's changing quickly. What we're now seeing is a new wave of creation care awareness and action sweeping through the evangelical community. This is especially true within my generation. Today's evangelical youth and young adults are moving beyond our old truncated mission of focusing on a narrow list of issues. As the president of New York Divinity School, Paul DeVries, recently said in an interview on CNN, we want our focus to be as big as God's focus. This means that evangelicals care about abortion and the family, but it also means we care about poverty, injustice, AIDS, slavery, and yes, we care about the environment. Take me, for example. The son of a Bible preacher, I just graduated from a leading evangelical college where I majored in environmental biology. I now travel around the country raising awareness and engaging Christians in my generation with pressing environmental issues. I am an evangelical Christian, and I believe that God calls us to be good stewards of the earth and good neighbors to those we share it with. And there is a growing mass of people out there just like me. Evangelicals may be arriving late, but we are at last joining in the fight to save this planet and the people in it. And we will never give up hope.
And our final guest has always spoken up loudly and directly on behalf of the Earth. David Foreman now directs the Rewilding Institute. Dave?
Only 10 years ago, when the Wildlands Project began to look at the kinds of ecological wounds causing mass extinction, we didn't see global heating as a big enough deal for it to be one of the wounds. Unbelievable levels of extinction were happening because of direct killing, habitat destruction, fragmentation, loss of evolutionary and ecological processes, invasion by exotic species and diseases, and biocide pollution. But now, we know that the greenhouse effect may become the major cause of species extinction in the coming century. This knowledge has locked me back on my heels. It has smacked me in the face like a meteor out of the dark. In some ways, it is too hellish to behold. But it is the real world, muchachos, and we are in it. We need to speak out loud and clear as conservationists that it is the human population explosion that has driven industrialization the last 200 years, thereby causing the greenhouse effect. And as conservationists, we must be loud and clear that the human population explosion and catastrophic global heating will cause mass extinction.
Keeping you informed of the leading voices of the Earth, the weekly Earth Summit is the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Tune in each week on the Wild Side News. Following a short break, we bring you a few items from the news and then investigate what is happening to hundreds of sea creatures along the California coast when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.